are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, November 1st, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's Casual Friday, folks. My child's candy's sugar teeming through my veins, wearing a soft-collared shirt, and welcoming to the program Heather Parton, or Digby, from the blog Hullabaloo. Then joining us on the program, the former writer and editor at Deadspin. Incidentally, every writer and editor is a former at Deadspin as of this AM. And the former co-host of the formerly Deadspin Deadcast, David Roth, will be joining us. I would imagine Deadspin may come up in that conversation. Also on the program, for the fourth time in the history of the United States, House votes to formally initiate official impeachment inquiry, the President of the United States. Meanwhile, the American public is on board, and Donald Trump is now threatening a fireside chat.
Please, please, please happen and not be scripted.
Good luck on the second part. Key NSC aide testimony provides re-edification of a quid pro quo. And the Chicago teachers delegates have voted to end the strike. Full membership to vote soon. I've heard mixed things. Warren drops a comprehensive pay-for on Medicare for all. Democrats launch voting rights suits in North Carolina, Texas, and Michigan, and that's just the beginning. Oh, congratulations. The Keystone Pipeline sprung a leak. That bodes well for Keystone XL. And civilian casualties at a record high in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, Donald Trump flees New York State for the income tax-free sunny Florida, or Palm Beach, Florida. And Joe Biden fades in Iowa. Buttigieg is the new number three.
Yuck.
Uh-huh. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. First off, let me just say rest in peace. Jeff Trapp, who was a regular on the old Sam Steeder Show blog back in the days of Air America, has passed on. Sad to say. Rest in peace. Appreciate his involvement and all the involvement of all the folks who used to be on that site back in the day. That old movable type blog that we had when we first launched on the Majority Report in 2004 was the first online presence of anything on Air America. If you went to airamerica.com or airamericaradio.com, the only thing that was there was a picture of a microphone that was not clickable. They hadn't quite figured out what to do with it yet. And they'd already spent millions of dollars already on 100 pre pre-recorded comedy bits that nobody ended up using. But they didn't. They didn't really think to build a website. So the Majority Report Radio, Sam, which ultimately became the Sam Cedar Show blog, was the only thing there, and we would get somewhere around 20,000 to 30,000 unique visitors a day on a movable type blog at that time, which was nuts. And we would have per hour of the show, literally 1,500 comments per hour. And it was the Wild West back then. We did not do any moderating or anything like that. And this was at a very early period in the blogosphere. And a lot of those folks provided great contributions. So rest in peace. And all right. Also some other house cleaning to do. Folks, check out our Instagram page. You can follow us at majoritypublic.fm on Instagram and subscribe to the AM Quickie. It is totally free. Now, the other way you can get the AM Quickie is you can either go to amquickie.com, subscribe through there, or you can just use the app at majorityapp.com and you can get it on the app. And as always, you can become a member of the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Both the member show, the free show, and the AM Quickie, and an ability to watch the show live, and I am the show, and call the show, all on the app at majorityapp.com. It's been completely refreshed. All right, let's get into this. First off, yesterday, this was pretty actually big deal. Do we have any clip of any of we don't, we forgot to pull that, of the vote yesterday. It was a big deal. This has only happened 4 times in the history of the United States, when impeachment proceedings have been officially launched. The first was Andrew Johnson. The date escapes me, but I imagine it was around 1868 or so. Later, 1870s. He, of course, became president after Abraham Lincoln was shot, and he was a nut job, and he was basically preventing any of the really progressive bills that the Republicans at that time were trying to push in terms of Reconstruction. He was attempting to thwart. They impeached him in the House. They failed to convict him in the Senate by one vote. And my understanding is that they did so because they felt that he was going to lose in the election anyways, and they were excited to get him out. At that time, I don't think they ran on the same ticket, the VP and the president. And then, of course, we had impeachment proceedings against Bill Clinton. At that time, 36 Democrats voted with the Republicans to impeach Bill Clinton in the House. Or I should say the next one was Nixon. There was, I think, 2 Republicans out of like 400. It was like 401-2, I think, that was the vote to impeach, to do the impeachment inquiry with Richard Nixon. They never got to a vote to actually impeach Nixon. He resigned before that happened. Bill Clinton, 36 Democrats joined the Republicans in launching the impeachment inquiry back at that time. And just yesterday, the House voted in what was probably the most partisan. I don't know about Johnson's vote, but the much more partisan than it was even under Clinton vote. You had 232-196. Keep it right there. It was 231 Democrats. 2 voted no. 194 Republicans voted no, and 1 independent, Justin Amash, voted independent. Here is that that final vote right here.
On this vote, the yeas are 232, The nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection. The motion to reconsider is laid upon the table.
On the table. And there it is. And so the bottom line is this means that Donald Trump will be impeached, assuming he doesn't resign before the vote.
No way that happens.
And
don't make us laugh.
That's unlikely.
I mean, some people are actually saying this. I just, it's crazy. I mean, the guy, even just on a self-preservation level, what's the use is he to anybody if he resigns?
It's highly unlikely.
Also more prosecutable if he's not.
Well, so, I mean, this is why some of these guys do stay on. There isn't like a retirement plan for Putin or Mugabe or something.
Right.
Like that's the same model.
Right. Right. On some level, that's exactly right. Now, he also could get hit by a bus, but more than likely
have a heart attack.
He's going to
do him like they did Gaddafi.
He's going to be impeached by at least that vote. Now, the other two Democrats, one from New Jersey, actually. And where was the second one from again? I can't remember. It was Minnesota. It was Colin Peterson, Jeff Van Drew. Those are both Donald Trump districts. Now, there was 31 other districts. Trump only won by 5 points in Van Drew's district. I don't know, what he's thinking, but it's quite possible that Van Drew and Peterson, once they see the evidence, will then vote for Peterson much more less likely. Apparently Trump won by 30 votes there. I mean 30 percentage points. But it's very possible that when Van Drew at the end of the process there's enough evidence he votes then. But either way, Donald Trump will be impeached and it will go to the Senate. And we don't know what's going to happen there. Susan Collins is probably the only one who is likely to vote for his impeachment, but they're going to be in big trouble because 65% of the Republican Party strongly favors Donald Trump. Strongly favors Donald Trump. If there was a very strongly favors Donald Trump, I would say 64% probably would very strongly.
Oh, yeah.
Favors Donald Trump more than your own family.
More than your own family.
I came and I personally defrauded you on a university course, and you still love it.
He's their daddy.
It is the case.
You like when daddy takes your money? You can really be like my kids. I can abuse you personally.
All right, let's just play this clip before. Let me do this ad first. One of today's sponsors is BetterHelp, and BetterHelp is giving our audience 10% off their first month. When you go to BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport, BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. When you sign up, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with that therapist in less than 24 hours. If you're not happy with your therapist, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason for no additional charge. They have over 3,000 licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. And particularly, I mean, if you live in a rural area, it's sort of amazing that something like this hasn't existed before now. You don't have to drive to an office. You don't have to sit around in a waiting room. You can do everything from the comfort of your own home. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than traditional in-person therapy. They have a financial aid option if you qualify. They're giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to BetterHelp.com/MajorityReport. That's BetterHelp, the word better, then HELP.com/MajorityReport. Also, we've talked about Blinkist from time to time. If you're like me and you feel like you can't find the time to read all the books on your list, well, Blinkist is an app that compiles the key takeaways from thousands of nonfiction books. Everything you need to know is condensed into 15 minutes. You can either read it or you can listen to it on their app. Blinkist is super unique. It has all of these different titles. It works on your phone, on your tablet, on your web browser. You can read two books on self-help or on history in the time that it takes you to walk to the subway. I mean, it depends on how far away from the subway you live. But You'll find everything from health and self-help titles, like I say, business books included in Blinkist libraries. For me, my biggest Blinkist wins were the 4-hour work week, that Tim Ferriss one. I know, I got very stuck on Tim Ferriss for a long time.
You loved Tim Ferriss.
I got very emotional.
When you came
and
you had your coconut phase, you're like, I have coconut butter and sardines because of Tim Ferriss.
That's right. Well, the sardines, I don't think was Tim Ferriss. But the coconut oil, that lasted only a couple of days.
I put butter in my coffee because Tim Ferriss
did. I did do that, too. I did that bulletproof coffee. That was from that. But there's also stuff like Fire and Fury, that Michael Wolff book. Like, you don't want to read through the whole thing. This is great to get some of the key takeaways of that, just in case you didn't know that Donald Trump is a horrible person. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books. All the books you want, and for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer for our listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. You can try it for free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, BLINKIST.com/majority. Start your 7-day trial for free and save 25% off when you decide to subscribe, and you will, because it's awesome. All right, let's this was really funny. Kyle Kulinski, who you may know, is a is he bread tube? Are we bread tube?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Friend of show.
But friend of show, Kyle Kulinski.
Secular talk
was on Joe Rogan again, right? This is his second.
I think it might be his third time.
Oh my God, that guy's on there all the time. And Kyle Kulinski was on the Joe Rogan show. Now, this is interesting because in the past, we've heard Joe Rogan say that Dave Rubin, I don't think he came out and said Dave Rubin is dim, but I think he did say something to the effect of, like, there's a lot of times Dave Rubin's in over his head.
Right? I think the phrase he used was cognitively limited.
That's right.
We didn't know exactly if he was talking about Dave Rubin, just to be clear. I mean, one could,
but wasn't that in the context of that conversation where
I think Weinstein made it about Rubin. If I remember, I think Rogan was doing the, like, hey, hypothetically, what if there's this wounded antelope guy who has no idea what he's talking about?
I think
whatever, it doesn't matter.
The sequencing was.
He was talking about Dave,
but you know, we don't know. But there's
talking about Sam Harris.
There's a thing called subtweeting. Where you're talking about somebody on a tweet or you're writing about it and you don't say their name specifically. I think it actually started out when you didn't at them, and then it sort of like grew into just talking about it. Now, I don't know who Joe Rogan could be talking about in this clip. Let's play the Joe Rogan clip first, because he's talking about they're talking about the way that people label themselves.
Northern Saudi Arabia this week, authorities knew they had another case of rich witchcraft on their hands, a capital offense in the ultra-conservative desert kingdom. Is that really what it is? Is that conservative? That term, that term is like way too wide.
Pause it. It is. It is conservative. I don't know that I would call it necessarily I would say it's politically conservative. I mean, let's be honest. The conservative movement in this country right now, you could look at Charlie Kirk got yelled at the other day by some conservative Christians who, that's what they do. They have problems with things like homosexuality. They have things that are pagan. They have problems with it is.
They hate Halloween.
It is conservative. Now, you might want to say, like, religiously conservative, you want to get specific, but I quibble, and that's not relevant.
I think both are. I think the idea, like, liberal, conservative, it casts such a wide net. Because,
and then people like to get sneaky and use, no, I'm a classic liberal.
Yeah, because
What is that?
Exactly.
You're a fucking Republican.
And it's funny because there's actually, when you actually look at the textbook definition of a lot of these terms, they have multiple meanings.
Yes.
So classical liberal.
All right, pause it for 1 second. I'm just trying to think, where have I heard this term classic Republican? Keep that where it is, but let's where have I heard that term classical liberal before? I'm trying to think. It's on the tip of my tongue.
What is a classical liberal? It sounds like someone who's a liberal, but perhaps a bit fancier. Maybe sporting a top hat, a twirly mustache, and a monocle.
Tea time!
While that might be true in some specific cases, there's a lot more to it than that, and I bet I can convince you that there's a little classical liberal in you, too, in about 2 minutes.
Me?
Classical liberalism.
All right, pause
it.
That is, of course, a Dave Rubin. In fact, that is Dave Rubin's, I don't know. It is his, what would you call that? There's got to be some type of literary term for his essence, expressing
manifesto.
His essence. Manifesto, yeah. Yes.
Core brand.
A declaration of Dave Rubinhood. All right, well, let's go back to Joe Rogan. Now that we know who Joe Rogan could be talking about. I mean, can you name another person who identifies themselves as classical liberal?
No, if I wanted to find others, I'd probably go to Dave Rubin's show and see who he interviewed.
Now, how many of those people who identify as a classical liberal have been on Joe Rogan's show that Joe Rogan comes in contact with? I mean, we're talking about a subset of people that is one. It's Dave Rubin. He's got to be talking about Dave Rubin, right? But maybe we'll hear him say Dave Rubin's name. Let's see.
I think both are. I think the yes. idea, like liberal, conservative, yes. it casts such a wide net because.
And then people like to get sneaky and use, no, I'm a classic liberal.
Yeah, because
oh, what is that? What is that?
Exactly.
You're a fucking Republican.
And it's funny because there's actually, when you actually look at the textbook definition of a lot of these terms, they have multiple meanings.
Yes.
So classical liberal, in some instances, means just like libertarian, because
yes.
that's what it used to mean back in the day. But in today's day and age, like you said, it could mean you're kind of right-leaning.
Yeah, it's more right of center.
Right.
They call it classical liberal is a very, it's a misleading term.
Mm.
Classical.
Wait a second. So there's a cut there. Will you go back? I didn't notice that before.
Kind of right-leaning.
Yeah, it's more right of center.
Right.
They call it classical liberal is a very it's a misleading term. If classical liberal. Classical liberal is it's a British term, correct?
Well, I think it originally dates back to it was
wow,
a way
wait,
of describing
that's weird.
Libertarianism.
Okay, so there's a cut there. I wonder if he goes on and actually names Dave Rubin. Only Kyle would know. I mean, I'm assuming it was the Rogan people. Maybe Rogan went too far in naming Rubin and then later felt like I shouldn't name Dave Rubin. But we gotta find out from Kyle. I don't know.
Like, what does Joe Rogan have to fear from Dave Rubin?
I don't know that he has anything to fear, but
he would
also,
just feel bad.
Yeah, he may
just
feel bad.
Yeah,
he's
he was
a wounded
talking
antelope.
About bullying the cognitively
he's a,
limited.
He's a
that's right.
wounded antelope.
We
he's
shall
nicer
see.
Than us.
The Blazes, Dave Rubin, lives in his own.
I'm a classical liberal.
Liberal universe. All right. Well, we
probably have a little bit in you, too.
We should ask Kyle about that. Or maybe Kyle will do a video and talk about that cut.
Yeah,
have you, do they cut often in Joe Rogan's show? My sense is they don't do that.
I don't watch enough to know.
I don't know.
No, I watched like most of the Barry Weiss one to punish myself, and there were not a lot of cuts.
Were there any cuts?
I don't remember.
I mean, doesn't he do it live? I don't know. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby.
A very strange thing going on, not with Dave Rubin, but with the crowd of people that is just trying to eat Dave Rubin and blind him and confuse him.
Mm.
And this, there's this guy, Sam Cedar, who...
Do you think he's a Russian?
I hope he is. Well, I don't know. I don't think he's Russian, but I do think that I think he has a grassroots following. I don't think this is inauthentic. That just loves to... dunk, drag. I hate this language. I just
I like
can't.
Dunking. I like the word dunk.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's fun.
No, I'm not a fan.
No?
No. No, because it cheapens all conversation. Oh, you got dunked on. You got dragged. Just like, oh, this is that thing in third grade that I never figured out.
Well, they found out that he won't engage with them. And so they think it's cute to just constantly shit on him. And they also think it's cute to take anything that he says and interpret it in the worst possible way possible and not think of it as him just being a guy who's trying to talk about things on the fly
right.
and maybe isn't even prepared about the subject at hand. Like, one of the things that comes up on this show, like, you know, we were talking before we were going to go on there. What were we going to talk about? I'm like, come on, let's just talk.
Yeah.
And so when you do that, come on, let's just talk thing.
Yeah.
You never know what the fuck is going to come up, and you might have a piss poorly formed idea of what a subject is.
Oh, boy. All right. Oh, folks. It's Casual Friday. Welcome back. I'm Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. And this song will introduce our next guest.
Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah. Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah.
I feel like if someone actually made the effort, that could be a great wedding, like, band song, I feel like.
It could. I could see that.
Digby, always a pleasure. Of course, the proprietor of Hullabaloo and a writer at Salon.com. So, Heather, this is, you know, it's a little bit anticlimactic because we didn't really need this vote like they did in the past because of changes in congressional rules in terms of what various committees can do on their own. But we saw a historic vote to impeach a president yesterday. It feels sort of, I don't know. I mean, I don't, I can't remember when it happened with Clinton, and I was so sort of like, this is ridiculous, that I don't know that I don't remember paying attention to it any more or less than my senses. America's paying attention to this vote, but what's your sense of like where this is landing?
Well, I think, I mean, I remember the Clinton vote, and I remember that the, and I mean, this just tells you how things have changed. There were 31 Democrats who voted to open the inquiry. You know, that was their big vote to start the process. And 31 Democrats voted with the Republicans. I think there were a couple of Republicans who defected on the other side, and everyone was so relieved that more Democrats hadn't crossed the line. Clinton was kind of worried that there were going to be, you know, 50, 75, who knew how many were going to actually vote for his impeachment in that original vote. And of course, this time there were two, and you know, both of them are douchebags. So you know, it was, and no Republicans came the other way. So you know, things are different in that sense. But I honestly think this was more of, you know, this is sort of laying, this was Nancy Pelosi sort of laying out the game, in that she showed that she has a, you know, she can count votes. I mean, whatever you think of her as a strategist or on policy or whatever else, she is really good at counting votes. And so the first vote she scheduled was one that was going to be overwhelmingly, you know, Democratic, that she had the full caucus together for the vote. And I think that was something that she had wanted to show going into this process, that the Democrats were
completely unified. Yeah.
And Trump also, in a way, it worked for him. I think we talked about this, and that he, you know, he needed a vote to sort of bolster the Republicans and say, hey, you know, look, we're all together on this, and show that there weren't any defections, and there weren't. So that worked for him as well. However, polling out today, I think in the ABC, the Washington Post poll, shows that, he's down to 74% approval with Republicans.
Yep. Now, 65% of it is very strong approval, though. I mean, that's what's interesting. He's bleeding, obviously, some of those like sort of shaky ones, and that's about 10 to 12 points down, I think, from where it was at its high.
It is, but this is significant. I mean, you know, he can't win with just his 65% of Republicans who strongly approve of him. I mean, that's a lot of people, tens of millions. We know, you know, that they're out there, but that's not enough to win re-election. That's a very problematic number for him. He really needed to keep, you know, in the high 80s or, you know, somewhere around 90% of Republicans sticking with him to even have a hope. So that's a very bad number. Maybe it's an outlier. I haven't seen anything that low in any of the other polling. But it's interesting, if somehow or another in all this, that some of the people who've been sticking with him, you know the types who are saying, well, I don't like the tweets, and you know, but those tax cuts, you know, those kind of people, if they're starting to go, you know, I can't do this anymore. You know, Trump fatigue, which I think is probably, you know, it's got to be a thing among, I know I feel it, but I mean, even among Republicans, there have to be some that are just going, come on, you got to be kidding. You know, now we're going to do impeachment? Oh, for God's sakes. So, you know, I do think that the vote yesterday may have been a moment for Trump that was, you know, it may end up being the high water moment for him as we go into a process that's going to be a lot more fraught for him as the hearings and various, you know, there's new information pouring out every day. And then the Senate, where I assume he's going to be acquitted, I think it's a very tall order to try and get 20 senators to cross over. I'd be shocked if, I mean, I don't know what would make that happen, but even if a few do, or even if it's a very ugly process and there's a lot of information and it's very, you know, this is something that the public watches in horror, you know, I think it's a problem because what we're really talking about is re-election, and this is not going to help him. Let's just put it that way. This isn't going to help.
I want to pivot in a moment because at the end of the day, I'm not quite convinced that it is that impeachment really is the most important feature of impeachment is about his reelection. I actually think that it has much more implications in the House and the Senate, but I don't want to get there yet because I want to just stay on sort of on Donald Trump for a moment. They're at this thing and it's possible. I mean, I feel like that number in terms of who supports him could really fluctuate. I mean, let's presume that could be just a glimpse. I suspect that his approval rating is a little bit higher than that. I mean, and I think it's also quite possible that there are people when those shaky people, when asked in a poll now, are like, yeah, no, I don't support him. You know, I think some of that bleed is that, and that when they come to vote, they'll vote for him anyways. But we're on the verge now of things are going to get very different. We're going to read all those depositions. And I think, you know, I don't think this is a situation where we're like, wait a second, Bill Taylor actually exonerated him. And boy, they were really mischaracterizing what, you know, that Sunderland lied and all this. Because I think one of the things that came out with this last testimony from Tim Morrison, who was the NSC, an advisor to Bolton, he's mentioned in the chats that went between Sunderland and Bill Taylor, who was the former ambassador to Ukraine, who was working on this, who was sort of like really taken aback at what was going on with all these political appointees. Sunderland was one of those political appointees. He's an EU ambassador, a hotelier who gave $1 million to Donald Trump's inauguration. He was sort of the ringleader working with Giuliani on the outside. Rick Perry is sort of more peripheral, but was definitely involved in all this. But this guy Morrison basically said, from what we understand, and this is all secondhand because we haven't seen the deposition, but basically said something to the effect of like, I didn't think the call was a quid pro quo, but I did refer it to our lawyer because I was a little bit concerned about it. And then he said, I did have a conversation with Sunderland where Sunderland said, the president said this is not a quid pro quo. However, he does want this for that, essentially. And so his testimony reestablishes the idea of the quid pro quo. And let me ask you this, what I think is an interesting dynamic. And I think what, you know, hopefully the Democrats will lay this out in public in a thoughtful way that will feel like it's building on itself rather than repeating itself. Because one of the things I'm concerned about is every time we get another account of how there was a quid pro quo, it feels like it diminishes the amount of stuff that's already on the record. In other words, like, why do we have to keep proving this? We have 4 different elements of proof. Every time we add another one, it makes it seem like the 4 other elements are not sufficient. And that it gives the Republicans the opportunity to attack one narrow one. Like, right? Like, they'll go like, well, Vinland, this Ukraine expert, he really likes Ukraine. So maybe that's why he's doing this. And You know, Bill Taylor, he was once dropped on his head when he was a baby. And he, you know, do you know what I'm saying here? Like, is there a danger of that?
I think there is. And I think that that's something that the White House and Trump sort of instinctively understands is a way for him to discredit this whole thing. You know, if they really had the goods, would they be doing all this? Would they have to talk to all these people? And of course, we do have the goods. Number one, it's in that rough transcript that was released by Trump, the biggest mistake he's made in his career thus far. It's in there. He says it. We all read it, you know, and he's out there screaming, read the transcript, never linking to it on his Twitter feed, by the way. So, you know, that's kind of a tell. But, you know, we know that it happened because we saw what he personally said. And we understand, you know, we can see that he came out later and said, yeah, what's the big deal? Yeah, of course, I was after corruption. There's no quid pro quo. I just did blah, blah, blah. But we know what happened. I mean, that is just, it's clear in that transcript. Now, if you're building a case in court, you know, you want to have corroborating witnesses and do all that stuff, which is basically what they're doing with this inquiry and talking to all these other people, trying to build an airtight case. But because of the way that it's dribbling out in this sort of, you know, some of these people have opening statements. One of the reasons why this guy Morrison yesterday, his testimony seems a little bit less obvious, and you know the Republicans raced out to leak their part of it, and then you know we heard things from obviously from the Democrats on the other side. It's because he didn't do an opening statement, or at least he didn't release one to the public, which many of the other witnesses have done. So we're getting this sense of, I think it's exactly what you say, which is one reason, and for the first time, I'm sort of glad they're moving quickly, because I think it's important to stop that particular dynamic from really taking hold, that, you know, gee, they're not really sure of themselves. They keep asking. This is what the Republicans are going to be saying, which is, look, they're going to keep asking until they find somebody who can prove it, you know. And that's not, you know, that's like, you know, they're going to keep looking until they find the votes to get Al Gore elected or whatever. You know, it's the kind of thing that they commonly do. So it is a problem. But on the other hand, you've got Trump, and his strategy is just inane. I mean, last night they published an interview with the Washington Examiner. He says, we're not going to have a war room. I'm just going to do this. You know, it's obvious. I'm going to have fireside chat where I read the transcript. And we're putting out T-shirts that say read the transcript. I mean, that seems to be the essence of his entire strategy here, is to say read the transcript, which is insane. Because if you read the transcript, it's basically proof that he did what he's accused of. So this is a very bizarre situation. I think a lot of it just has to do with the fact that he's uncontrollable. And, you know, the people in the Republicans in the House who were going to be in charge of doing this have proven themselves to be batshit crazy as well.
Right.
I mean, they're just running around, you know, pulling stunts and doing whatever. And they think, look, this worked in the Mueller investigation, which was basically all based upon leaks by certain people who were involved, and the press was revealing certain things, and it was all sort of coming out piecemeal. And Trump had this repetitive, you know, he had this mantra, you know, no collusion, no obstruction, it's a witch hunt, and he denigrated the investigators. And that worked for them, and sadly, I think it kind of did. So they're trying to do a reprise of that, but this is happening way too fast. And they're about to go public. I mean, those transcripts are going to be released, and they're going to have hearings. So,
and the problem is, this is being
away with it.
Yeah, this is being controlled by the Democrats. So it's much harder for them to for the White House to sort of control the pace of it. All right, so let's go back to that other the other thing though. I wanted to mention was that, and I think, you know, people should just, I just want to reemphasize your point about this vote being important to Trump, in terms of he wants to lock them in. Like, once you vote against the need for the impeachment query, you have another bite at the apple if you're a Republican in a, let's say, a purplish district. And there's not many of them. There may be not even a dozen or something at this point. But if you, you know, that you take this vote, you can go back and vote if things get really egregious. But essentially, you're in for a penny, you're now in for a pound on that side. And that's why he wanted to make sure there's no defections. Now you're all attached to me. if I go down, you're coming down with me is basically his strategy, I think, for that. I mean, for me, all of this is about, because I don't know at the end of the day if 9 months from now it's going to make a difference, or whatever it is, a year from now, it's going to make a difference that he was impeached in the House and not convicted in the Senate, in terms of who's going to come out and vote against him and who's going to come out and vote for him. But it seems to me that it's going to make a big difference, this vote, if I'm running against Susan Collins, or I'm running against Cory Gardner, or I'm running against Joni Ernst, or I'm running against Tom Tillis, or I'm running against Sally McAdams. I think it's going to make a big difference in those races. And if I'm running against one of those Republicans who remain in a purplish district, you know, like somebody like the Texas district, and you know, a lot of those people resigned, so they didn't want to take the vote. I think that's going to make a big, big difference at this point.
Well, it does. And I think that sort of explains the timing issue. And, you know, I've talked about this a lot.
Yep.
We were both intensely frustrated about the idea that why are we rushing through this thing, you know, let's drag it out. Let's torture him, you know, through
right.
the whole campaign. Why are we doing this? And it seems like this is really what they had made a decision to focus on. They're not saying it out loud, of course, but this was about gaining control of the Senate. The rush in it is to try and get these, you know, to corner these vulnerable Republicans, and there are a bunch of them. You just named them, and there are actually a few more that could theoretically be in trouble if, you know, this looks like a big landslide election, and you know, they could be taken down in this, and they are being cornered on this, and the Republicans are kind of sense the desperation is starting to pour off of them on this, because. You know, first of all, Trump yesterday, he had a bunch of GOP senators up to the White House for lunch, you know, after the vote, you know, kind of obvious. And
nothing going
on.
Just wanted to see you guys.
Yeah, just saying, no biggie. Just wanted to check in.
Didn't make the history books at all today or anything like that. Nothing.
Exactly. And apparently, you know, he had them up there and he was going on and on about how the call was perfect and all this stuff. And I'm sure they're all sitting there rolling their eyes going, Jesus, you know, okay, thanks a lot. And then, you know, there's also reports that he's out there basically bribing them. You know, saying, "Hey, I will, you know, set loose the financial spigots, all the donors, if you make a commitment to backing me in the impeachment," and then the opposite. I mean, he's not giving them any room. He's not helping. You know, that what you a normal person would do. He knows that it takes 20, right? To get them normal, he'd say, you know, "Hey, guys, do what you have to do."
Right. I need to. I'm willing. Okay, this is really important, and I also want to make something explicit that you brought up when we talked about this on Ring of Fire the other day, because this, I think, point is really and it hadn't been something that I had contemplated in terms of rushing it. In all those states that we just mentioned, those senators, for at least the majority of them, I haven't checked every single one of them, but I'm pretty sure it's more or less the same. The deadline to file, if you're a primary challenger against one of those Republican senators, is mid-March. So if the vote comes after that deadline, Susan Collins may feel more comfortable voting against impeaching the president.
Right.
Cory Gardner may feel more comfortable against impeaching the president, because the threat that they're going to get primaried by a Trumpista is gone at that point, because nobody can jump in the race. But if the vote happens February 12th or February 1st or March or January 15th or even March 1st for that matter, then they are sure to get primaried by some Trump-loving lunatic who is then going to force these candidates who are already stuck in between a rock and a hard place to tack to the right to make up for the fact that they made this vote. And so this is becoming increasingly about those five or six, maybe there's seven or eight, this could be expansive in that way, Senate seats. And if Donald Trump was smart, he would say, I'm going to release you guys, because 20 is when I go in trouble. If eight of you vote to, you know, against impeaching me, I'll release you. Now, but I still think they have that problem that you brought up about the deadlines. And so those Senate, I mean, this is all, it seems to me, about the Senate at this point. And that's what I think everybody needs to sort of like watch this stuff with an eye to those specific senators, because what they do is going to is going to be telling. And, you know, even like a guy like Tom Tillis is like, no way will I vote for impeachment. He can say that. And then it may change after the deadline. But he doesn't want anybody to even think about running against him in North Carolina, because that's a perfect example of a state where, like, if he has to tack any like a step or two to the right, he's in big trouble, it seems to me. And
well, I mean, look at Lindsey Graham. I mean, that's a perfect example. I mean, he's South Carolina, right? You would think he has no worries. He is, you know, that is he is, you know, in like Flint, and yet he is having to do backflips, twist himself into a pretzel to ensure that he does not get a primary, you know, challenger from the right. This is the dynamic that's driving them in the, you know, in these senators. And even in places like that, which is as deep red as it gets, there is this fear that if you just deviate even one tiny bit, that you're going to get this primary challenge. And then at the same time, in the purple states, they've really got to worry that, you know, backing Trump, especially, you know, with this new polling, you know, looking, I mean, it is a majority, even people over 65 are in favor of impeachment and removal now. I mean, this is, you know, this train is hurtling down the track, and they are between a rock and a hard place. And I think you're absolutely right that a lot of this strategy, which I don't think was evident as we were kind of, you know, coming up to it. And by the way, just in defense of those of us who were screaming for impeachment and saying, you know, what the hell is wrong with Nancy Pelosi or whatever, a lot of what Pelosi and Schumer and the rest of the Democratic leadership were doing were floating trial balloons to see what their people were thinking, right? I mean, they needed to know there's a reason why they say and do the things that they do that goes beyond just, you know, there's a political purpose. And that was to gauge the activist left, to gauge the regular, you know, they're polling, they're doing focus groups, they're seeing what people like us say on social media and all that stuff. So I'm not going to apologize for having, you know, put tons and tons of pressure in what small way I can on the Democrats to follow through with impeachment, because it was important that they understood there were those of us out there that were demanding that. But as we see this unfolding, I think we can see the strategy of sort of waiting to this certain point and then boom, you know, kind of putting these senators on, you know, in a really difficult place. You know,
I'm not 100% sure. I've changed my mind a little bit about it in terms of the pacing. Like, I thought this should last till April, and now I think it should last until February. Yeah. But I don't think Nancy Pelosi ever wanted to impeach. I don't think that ever happened until probably 3 weeks ago when they saw the polling. I think, you know, I still look at that reporting that Ryan Grimm did. The fact is during August, when even those frontline Democrats went home, they got an earful from their constituents and they realized, like, you know, if we don't vote to impeach, I'm going to lose the only sure bets I have in that district. And so I can't start building on, you know, as we used to say in Risk, you can't go to Irtusk until you've got Kamchatka. I'm not pronouncing it right. I can't remember, but that was just a dumb saying.
Well, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The August recess was important, and it didn't, you know, it's funny because it really wasn't organized. That was pure spontaneous, you know, backlash from the constituents in those districts. I mean, I guess that Move On did some stuff. There were, you know, impeachment August or whatever, but I didn't get the sense there was just some big.
Well, Tom Steyer was collecting email addresses, so there's that. All right, listen, we have just literally two minutes left here, 3 minutes. So let's just sort of like broadly speaking, Warren came out today with a specific plan to finance Medicare for all. And it calls for, and her plan apparently is a little bit more expensive than outlined in Bernie Sanders' plan. Now, she is talking about the implementation of Medicare for All, the bill that Bernie Sanders introduced and that she co-sponsored along with about another half dozen or dozen senators, maybe. Give me your sense of this, because there's, you know, like, I'm seeing people saying that this is devastating because this is going to allow Donald Trump to win. And, you know, I think, and this is coming from, you know, sort of more, I don't want to say centrist Democrats, but more sort of like, you know, I don't know.
Fearful Democrats. I mean, I, you know, I just, this is ridiculous. I do not see this as being politically risky in the way that these people are talking about. I mean, look, none of us, and I shouldn't speak for you, but I'll speak for myself here. I don't have a deep understanding of healthcare financing in this country or the way that these things are going to be implemented in terms of the details are not things that I am personally going to delve into. I'm not a healthcare expert. I'm not a financial expert. But I do observe politics pretty closely, and I think that in this election, you know, you are in a situation where I think that the electorate is looking, I don't know what they're looking for, but I think it's smart for any politician to think big. We are in a position where, you know, things have gone completely off the rails. I think there is an argument to be made that we need fundamental reform. And healthcare is one area where that has to happen. Now, for whatever reasons, the Democrats have decided that everyone has to put out a highly detailed plan about everything that they're going to do, unlike, you know, say, Donald Trump, who said, I'm building a wall and Mexico's going to pay for it, and that was good enough. So the Democrats want more detail, fine. They've got the detail from her. They've got detail from other of the candidates. And I think that what the overall message is there is that we are, you know, if the Democrats take over, we're not just going to, I'm not talking about Joe Biden here, but even his plan is more detailed than in more
right.
Revolutionary than one might expect from him. But that, you know, that they're going to say, look, you know, we're not just going to go back to the status quo. Let's pretend that none of this Donald Trump stuff happened. We recognize that this is a sign that something has gone terribly awry and we're going to have to fix a lot of things. Fundamental reform. And I think that's Elizabeth Warren's brand. And I think that she's, you know, quite good at it. I don't, you know, the politics of this, we're all going to squabble amongst ourselves over the details, pretending like we know what they are and pretending like this plan is going to come, you know, be fully formed and be enacted exactly as the way she wrote it. But the reality is that the signal all of this sends to the electorate is, you know, look, we're not kidding here. This is serious business. We have to do something very, very, you know, fundamental to reform everything, government, healthcare, you know, the economy, all these things have to be dealt with because look where it led. It led to Donald Trump. And I think it's a damn good message. I really do. I think the Democrats would be wise to embrace it and run with it because I think people, you know, there's some sense of just kind of, you know, there's a fear in the pit of our stomach, like, geez, you know, how did this happen? Well, you know, the Democrats are telling the
right.
people how it happened.
I mean, I think, like, you know, it's clear, you know, at this point, Sanders has put out about a half dozen different options that would be pay fors. Warren got more specific to a certain extent because she was sort of boxed in on her refusal to talk about raising taxes, you know, about, you know, to talk about costs as opposed to taxes. And her plan, at least from a political standpoint, and I think there's some question as to whether the financing is, you know, ultimately could work this way. I've seen some critiques on that. Some people have said that it's really just more of something like the way that she's offloading a lot of the tax burden on employers is something you could do on a temporary basis, but ultimately employers would find workarounds. Mm-hmm. That's all well and good. This is her ability to say no raising of taxes on the middle class. Now, she's also calling for things like cuts in military budget to pay for this, which mm-hmm. I think that's also a good sort of political message. And I agree with you. This notion of watching people with their hand wringing about a Medicare for all or any of these proposals as to, like, you know, people are not going to want to allow rich people to go to college for free. That's going to be so offensive to people in the general election, or the idea of, like, Donald Trump's going to get out there and he's going to be able to effectively message you're going to lose your private health insurance if you get, you know, full coverage from the government is just absurd. Like, in a total sort of, like, normalized, barely people pay attention to politics universe, the idea of, like, hey, out of blue, people are saying you're going to lose your private insurance. I could see What? I haven't been paying attention to anything in politics lately, but I don't want to, you know, wait, what's this whole thing? In the context of the political era that we're living in, the idea of like losing my health, you know, private health insurance for everything else to be paid for, you know, like to get like a complete free ride, it just doesn't have the same political salience that it would have at another time. And I think people have got to get through that through their heads and get with the program. But we're going to talk more about this in the future, Heather. And I appreciate, I think that's a very good first salvo as we head into the next 12 months or so.
Yeah, it's not the last we're going to hear about healthcare in this campaign. I think we'll be talking about it quite a bit. But, you know, I'm glad we're talking about it. And all the big plans, I think they're great. I mean, that's exactly what the Democrats should be doing. Don't cower. My God. Yeah, that'll beat Donald Trump. Let's be afraid. Yeah, that's a great approach.
All right, let's just all look forward to the series of fireside chats that I hope Donald Trump.
Yes,
will give us.
I can't wait. And the T-shirts, I'm getting mine. Read the transcript. that's the best plan I've heard.
I want to read the transcript. We should be putting out those.
Yes, I think everyone should wear one because I think it's actually a good idea. But let's not buy them from the Trump campaign.
No, I'm going to print them up.
Put them out. Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
Thanks, Heather. We'll talk to you soon.
My pleasure. All right. Bye-bye.
Folks can check out Digby over at Hullabaloo, which is digbysblog.blogspot.com, if you can buy it, if you can believe it. I think it's also, I don't know what else. That's the one I know. Over at salon.com. All right, going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will talk to David Roth, formerly of the former Deadspin. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program the former writer and editor, or I should say a former writer and editor at the former Deadspin as of, I guess, today. David Roth, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
Oh, you know, this combination of dazed and wired that you'd love to feel on a Friday morning.
Right, of course.
It's weird. I feel a little bit better now than I did yesterday. I think just knowing that I don't, you know what's coming for us, but I sure was dreading another, you know, week or two of watching things slowly get worse. So
I have been in similar situations, and that is it's a nightmare. I wouldn't wish it upon anybody. And I think at least having some resolution gives you a sense of like, okay, this is where it's like when you are sitting in an Italian restaurant with your back against the wall. At least you can just see the front door, and you don't think you're going to get taken out from behind.
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing. It all happened so fast. I mean, I used to joke about this, that I'd had all the different types of shitty online media ownership experiences. And I didn't, like, this is ordering off the menu to keep the restaurant thing going. Like, I didn't realize that the stuff that's happened to us since Monday was, like, an option. Like the stuff about being pivoted out of a job, like by some like venture backed thing, like that's fine. I mean, it's not fine, but it's the thing that happens. And then, you know, I worked at Vice, which is kind of to me like a, or at least at the time felt like a strange sort of Potemkin scheme, you know, like kind of pump and dumpy. And I was, you know, there's a lot of that on the internet too, but like, in this case, like just having some dude come back from vacation, like our CEO did on Monday, and then decide to like, whatever, just push everybody out the door. I didn't think that that would happen.
All right. Well, we got to back up because I'm not sure that everybody is familiar with this saga. Oh, yeah. And so this starts really when Peter Thiel is upset that Gawker has outed him. And he basically starts into process a way of basically suing Gawker out of business. And then you want to take it from there? And that's right, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't
No, that's all correct. Okay. I mean, this is years before I started there.
Right.
But yeah, so this is the he backed Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against the website for that wound up resulting in a Florida courthouse, delivered a large, like a 9-figure damage ruling against the site, which declared bankruptcy. And then, you know, people lost their jobs. It was then sold at kind of a fire sale price to Univision, which was then working on its own sort of like, it seemed at the time like it was like a multicultural youth media push, which is like a cool idea, and there was plenty of room there. But this is where we start running into the really kind of like fraught stuff. Like,
and was it called Gizmodo at that point? Is that was it?
It was called, yes, that's worth mentioning. So the Gawker name was gone, and then so it rebrands as Gizmodo Media Group. Gizmodo being the site that deals with technology and all that in the sort of network of sites that was sold to Univision, and the Gawker staffers were distributed among other sites, and then eventually they started a new site, Splinter, that sort of took a lot of that and enfolded it. The Univision thing seemed promising at the time, and again, this was before I was there, I was still at Vice, but it was, the idea there was that it would be a sort of youth-oriented stuff that would be, you know, that would have bilingual, you know, like components, and that would, it really did seem at the time like they were committing enough resources to it that it could have been something cool. They were hiring a lot of people for Fusion, which was a new site they were starting, and they were paying, you know, it wasn't crazy salaries by the standards of other industries. But
unless
was,
you were Tim Pool, but go ahead.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, yeah, but they paying him like a major league, like a fifth inning guy, like a long reliever somehow.
This guy was getting, I mean, it depends, I guess, on your perspective, but and he was like in, I think in the media world, he was like getting like left-handed closer type of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
You love to see a guy that wears a GoPro on his head get Ryan Madsen money. That's what it's all about.
Yes.
So the but obviously, all respect, huge fan of his work, you know.
Yes, of course. Right.
But, all right, so the thing with Fusion at the time was that, like, if they had taken that money and decided that they wanted to build something that would last and that would do the work that they said it was going to do, I think it could have been cool. But that wasn't what they wanted, because Univision at the time wasn't really Univision. Univision was owned by a series of private equity, like a consortium of equity funds, some of which had like brand names attached, like Chaim Saban is like a big Democratic donor, and the guy that I think he literally made his money off Power Rangers. Like
That's right. That was him.
Which
and
of course,
whenever
you know, again,
whenever a Democrat does not criticize Israel, the two reasons are Chaim Saban.
So it turned out that Chaim Saban didn't actually want to do a multicultural youth media thing, which in retrospect, you know, you could imagine my shock. What they really wanted to do was something similar to what Vice was doing, which was to grow real fast, demonstrate with all these hires and all this stuff and all these resources that, like, you know, we're big, we're growing, we're ambitious, and that's why we want to sell to you at a high price. And they, you know, for what they were doing, they didn't really build anything that resilient because they were more concerned on, it seemed like, spending willy-nilly and then demonstrating that they were spending a lot, which was a model that, that worked all over the internet until it seems like now it's starting to slow down. I don't know if you want to credit Uber or WeWork or any of those things that, like, you know, pegged their whole valuation on how much money they lost somehow.
Well,
I
think it's worth just stopping here because, you know, ultimately I want to be able to, like, talk about what is going on in our culture. And I think that, you know, what has happened with Deadspin is a perfect example of it. But we should just sort of, like, to just, you know, raise this flag up the flagpole a little bit. This dynamic, which is, I mean, I think it's always existed, but really in the past 25 years, maybe since the first dot-com bubble, there is this notion that, like, you can build value in a company by, I mean, this is almost sort of like my daughter's business plan with her selling clothes on Depop. She gets the clothes for free from me. She sells them and makes it seem like she has a business. And on some level, like, what has been going on, like, this happens in YouTube channels. Like, at one point there's these umbrellas of YouTube channels where, you know, my relationship, with my umbrella organizations, I give them a percentage of my money and they help me, you know, sort of optimize my channel. I had people coming to me saying, we'll give you money to be part of our network. And I'm like, I don't get, how do they make money that way? And they don't. Yeah. They want to be able to show, like, we had $100 million worth of revenue. Now, of course, it cost us $120 million to get that $100 million worth of revenue. But the idea is that bigger, like, you know, private equity or other, you know, companies say, like, oh, well, we can cut costs. That's easy. We'll just take the revenue. And they don't quite realize that, like, well, yeah, I mean, I can make $10 million if you give me $11 million to spend.
Right. So this is what's so strange about it. And this is where it begins to sort of enter, you know, this continuum of, like, just M.C. Escher grade nonsense that, like, took us to where we ended up. Like, just all these bizarre thought paths and, like, forbidden mind realms, like, none of which seem to involve owning a profitable business, gathering those profits, keeping some for yourself, and then kicking it forward another year. That, like, this is what's been strange about it, is that all of that sort of, like, hustling and this attempt to have something and sell it to someone else for more than it's worth, and then, you know, patting yourself on the back for it and trying to do it again. Or what you were talking about in terms of the way that private equity has worked with newspapers, where it's, you buy something and then the goal is to make it shittier faster than advertisers can leave.
Right, exactly.
Which is a really strange approach. But it is, for all of that stuff, none of that to me seems nearly as sustainable as the idea of, I mean, this is the thing that's always been weird about it. Megan Greenwell, in what I think is, like, the definitive story.
I was just
going to
say
about,
this, cite this story.
Yeah. Well, but go ahead. I mean,
well, no, but before
it.
We get that, I want to, I didn't mean to sort of sidetrack, your basically your TikTok of this. So it's over at, Univision. They realize, like, oh, we don't really want to do what we thought we wanted to do. So they basically sell it at a discounted rate just to get it off their books.
Yeah. Severely discounted. Like, this is at this point, like, if we're going to stick with the baseball player metaphors, it was sold to Great Hill Partners, which is a private equity firm, for less than J.D. Martinez received this year from the Boston Red Sox.
Wow.
And J.D. Martinez is really good, but at the same time, not the highest paid player on the Red Sox, right? So right. That's what we're sort of talking about. The step with Great Hill that I think we didn't really anticipate, you know, being sold to a private equity concern was not great, but the reputation that Great Hill had among people that had worked there before, and, you know, media being media, there were people at GMG that had, was that, you know, if you had to be sold to a private equity concern, this was the one to be sold to. That, like, they were fairly hands-off, and that what they, you know, they wanted a profitable company. They correctly identified that relative to the traffic that we had and the cachet that the sites had, that these sites really were undervalued. And that a little bit of cleaning up after the neglect that Univision had allowed to creep in once it became clear that they weren't all going to make $1 billion off of our dumb blogs, that like a little bit of trimming here and there, like, and then, you know, the guy that I was friends with, our revenue chief, who's like many of the people in those positions since, was pushed out or fired. And he always used to say that there was a lot of juice left to squeeze on the site. We really didn't have very much in the way of ads relative to, you know, if you go to Sports Illustrated, I mean, that's always been like a gold standard in terms of journalism, but it's also been a gold standard in terms of like a very difficult website to read. Like, browsers hate it. Videos are playing all over the place. Ads are popping up and you have to close them. It's, and you know, that's, I guess that's what you have to do to make money on it, but we weren't really doing that much of that. So a little bit of that here and there, and then we're back in the black. And at that point, Great Hill could either sell us, or they could do what owners have always done, which is, you know, keep the profits for themselves and pay us. And I think that would have been fine. But the person that they had as a CEO, who put some of his own money into the purchase and was running our sites, was, and he's still the CEO there, his name's Jim Spanfeller, is just like an erratic guy and had a reputation as a very pugnacious dude. And so he kind of came in and, you know, that like stupid canard about like first day in jail, you got to find the biggest guy and like go up to him and yeah, like stab him with a chicken bone. So like, he just like walked into the company and like with a sharpened chicken bone in his hand and was like, all right, so who gets stabbed here? Like, what are we doing? And he continued to kind of, you know, he got rid of Splinter, the new site, a savvy move by any standards, right before a giant year long news cycle that everybody's going to be reading about.
That's, and kudos for reading the temperature of what was happening in the world. No one I come across is interested in hearing anything about like news or politics.
Well, not now. Days. I mean, maybe after the big news thing happens, then it's like, well, wait, I wasn't paying attention. What went down?
Right.
And that's where you strike. Right. So yes. Like December 2020, that's your moment. I think that in a lot of this, this is where I'm talking about the continuum of things that don't make sense. Like, now we are at the end of it, and this is where we sort of fell off the map. There's no business justification for pushing Splinter out. There's no business justification really for antagonizing the thing that wound up being the sort of tipping point with us, which was this edict that we not do posts on non-sports related things, which had always been a part of the mix at Deadspin, a small part, and a part that did, by, you know, post by post, did about twice as much traffic as the sports stuff we did. But, you know, 98% of what we did was sports. The issue there was not, and is not, that Spanfeller is some Trump partisan that hated that we wrote about the president and made fun of him. It was that I think he wanted us to do what he said. And he started with a position that was just basically antagonistic, and you know, he was very aggressive with our editor-in-chief, who later resigned, Megan Greenwell, who was trying to sort of you know, broker a peace between this guy that came in so ready for war and this group of people that just kind of wanted to continue doing our blogs at our profitable and fairly popular website. And you know, that just there was no getting to yes with the guy. And that was the stuff that quickly became clear, and it's why everybody left. I mean, that there's just, you know, we were never gonna, you know, this thing could have calmed down, but as soon as he had another bad day, it was, you know, just back at it.
Let's put up, I know we have Bernie's tweet with that is up, where he says, I stand with the former Deadspin workers who decided not to bow to the greed of private equity vultures like Jim Spanfeller. This is the kind of greed that is destroying. Yeah, he added him. That is destroying journalism across the country. And together we're going to take them on. Good for Bernie. But I want you to click on Jim Spanfeller, because I think all you really need to do is look at his profile pic. And it all makes sense. It all makes sense. And I mean, honestly, like, if I was going to just look on like a, you know, one of those sites, like a Getty site for a stock footage of what I think he should look like. That's the picture I would choose right there. I mean, yeah. The one where he's like, who he's literally looking up to God, who is taking his photo, it looks like. And
he is a difficult man. I'm not going to sit here and tell you he's not, but it's weird. I feel so naive about a lot of this, especially now, because when he started, like, yeah, he's like a weird, fluffy, kind of like loud guy. But like, you know, I've had worse, you know, like there's, or at least I thought I had at the time, you know, in terms of like absolute bosses, like I don't need to deal with those dudes, you know, that like, it's the sort of thing where like, if his thing and what he said at the start was like, I'm good at like, I'm doing deals, I make money. And, you know, as Megan wrote in her farewell thing, and I think as most of us felt, like we were like, I don't want to, you know, be on a, like in the middle seat on a long bus ride with this dude. But at the same time, like, if you want to go make money for our website, like, fine. Like, we'll do our part and you do your part. And, you know, like once a year at the Christmas party, we'll shake hands and that'll be that. And that just wasn't it.
Right.
And that's the part of it where, like, we tried to hold our end up of it. And this is the thing with, like, the non-sports stuff that he didn't want, that, like, a lot of those things did gangbusters traffic. And the idea that you had to go through something, like, my buddy Drew McGarry had this, you know, this weekly sort of, he'd answer reader questions. Like, reliably, a third of those were just about, like, pooping. You know, and that's fine. People have questions. No one really knows why we do it. Scientists have never figured it out. And there are, you know, like there's stuff there to answer, and he would give funny answers. But with all of that, if you start getting into parsing the percentage of poop questions versus NFL questions in a Drew McGarry mailbag, then like, what are you doing with your time? Like, how is that productive to us? And why would you take those page views away from us? Strictly so that you could say that we listened to what you said.
This is the most important part of this story. I mean, I mean, aside from obviously like the cost to individuals who are working there, but in terms of like a story about what is wrong with a certain aspect of our culture, this is the nub of it. And I do think like, and we should link to Megan Greenwell's piece. It was on August 23rd, called "The Adults in the Room," and she broadens it out a little bit here. And this is why I was so interested in having this conversation, because I went through the same dynamic at Air America, where
yeah, I was thinking that this was like one of those like you just can't get there from here things, and like you actually this is the closest that I could think of. Previously, but go, speak on it.
Well, because it's the exact same dynamic. It's like the story that these folks will tell is that there was a bunch of people, scallywaggy types of people who just like they're on a mission. They don't care about making money. They don't know the hard truths of this and that. But the fact of the matter is that, no, these people are idiots and they don't even their own egos. Well, there's two different ways to interpret this, and we literally had five different ownership groups at the Air America that represented almost every single variant of how management could screw it up. We had this guy Spanfeld. Like I read one piece like in Megan's piece where they said like, why would they buy a site they don't like? We had a CEO at Air America who came in on day one and he goes, I want you guys to know something. We're all sitting there. It's like the third time that we've done this where we gather in the conference room and they give us free pizza and basically say like, here's how we're going to shit on you now. And yeah. The guy got up in front of the room and he goes, I want to tell you something. I never even heard of Air America until after I got this job. And he was saying it like,
what a flex.
He was saying it like, that's why I'm uniquely situated to do this job. And yeah. We're just sitting there going like, how do you take a job to sell a product you've never even heard of? Never mind like you're not even vaguely interested enough to have ever listened to the network. And this was a badge of honor on their part that it really had nothing to do with the product. And then, of course, there was just a series of stuff like, hey, you're not following the money. But they're saying, like, for them, the story that everybody told about Air America was like, they only cared about doing the politics. No. Everybody there was like, we know that you need to make money to make this work.
Yeah.
And
that's embedded in the caring about doing, like, of course, like, we cared about our being able to do our commentary or being able to do that stuff. But, like, the only way that works is if they're also making money. Like, it's not the sort of thing where I expect somebody to just, like, absolutely eat shit for an infinite number of years while I, like, do a blog post about being like, are backpacks actually bad? I don't know. Like, here's 10,000 words. Like, that's, you know, you gotta, like, you give to get. I think that we all understood that. But yeah,
there's,
man,
two elements here that I think are, like, sort of, like, can be that can be pursued as a sort of broader dynamic. One is the sort of the low-hanging fruit where, like, this guy, Spanfeller, I've never met him. I don't know anything about him. His ego is too big to listen to people who are not, you know, at the same sort of station in terms of the way he perceives hierarchy. And even more importantly, he understands that his trajectory is a function of being the guy. And if there is a sense that he has that other people are contributing to the success of this, then he's afraid that he won't be the guy. And he may be right. He may be wrong. I don't know. And because he certainly has, you know, had a tremendous amount of success. And I can tell you that every person who sucked at Air America has gone on to suck somewhere else at more money.
Yeah.
Yep. And that's, I think, part of it. The other part of it, I think, that maybe a little bit less obvious is from one of the CEOs at Air America, who was a radio consultant, who came in and told me, like, we're going to make our radio channel centrist, but our website's going to be the most liberal website out there. We're going to be to the left. You know, we're going to be bigger than the Huffington Post. And I was like, you're the first guy in decades to do a completely horizontal business plan. That's brilliant. You should open up a shoe store and refuse to advertise on either one of those platforms. But for him, it was like success for him was, we need 100x. This is what you'll hear from these venture people when they get behind closed. Yep. We need 100x. Like, what you described as, they could make a profit. They could pocket some of the profit, put a little bit back in, and make it work. That's not sufficient for a lot of these entities. They need not to make, you know, plus 5% or 20% or whatever it is profit. They need to make 10 to 100 times the valuation, because they're only in the business to pump and dump. That's it. We need to sell this to somebody else, and so that we can provide for our hedge. Because people forget, a hedge fund is sort of like the way they used to do television pilots back in the old days, which is, we're going to do 20 of these. 19 are going to fail, but the 20th is going to pay for all of it. And so they're swinging for a home run every time they're at bat. And if they're not going to get a home run, then they want to walk off. They want the next batter, because that's their business model. And that is why all this wreckage exists in its path, because they don't care about something that's going to be profitable. They want something that is going to be so profitable, it's going to pay for all the other bad bets, because that's the way their business
lets you know how they tend to fail when it comes to, like, websites, say. Like, a blog does not go 10x or 100x or whatever. Like, this is inherently the sort of thing where, like, it's easy. Well, it's not easy, but I mean, you can make a decent amount of money consistently and grow consistently doing this stuff. But there's no way that, like, anything that is as labor intensive and as difficult to do as journalism can make money at that particular scale.
Yes, I think,
you know,
that's exactly right.
Instagram can, because Instagram is, the work is done by other people, and you're paying developers and you're trusting that other people are going to do that stuff. Or, I mean, it doesn't seem like a very good example anymore, but like Uber or Airbnb or a lot of these places where their gambit was just basically like, well, what if we didn't follow the law? Right. Would that be useful? And in that case, it's like, if you grow real fast and you raise a bunch of money, and like Uber got to this spot, and this is like, you know, obviously it seems like one of the kind of less urgent failures of the end of the Obama years, but it is one of those things where like, just like sort of letting those companies do whatever they want, because it was like, it was, you know, innovative or disruptive or whatever. Like, I think that it was bad business practice on the government's part.
Yes.
Because the idea, like, but it sends a very corrosive message, not just to voters and stuff, but I think to rich people, where if the model of the place is you grow so fast that an austerity stripped government actually can't discipline you, that you've outgunned the state because you have hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars in valuation and all these investors behind you, like the FTC does not have the firepower to win a battle against a company like that. And so you let those companies get to this point. I mean, obviously they've all collapsed under their own weight at this point, because the basic idea of it was, you know, I don't think they've collapsed, but they're like shrinking down to what their actual size is, which is something like a tenth of what they were considered to be.
Right.
And the idea of having something that you know what it is, it grows at a pace that you can control, and you can get a steady return on it, which was always the idea of like sort of, I assumed that an ownership type would want that. Because the alternative, I mean, or certainly would want it more than losing money. And yet it's a question now, as you're saying, like, what's the hierarchy of what they want? And what Spanfeller, who has a lot of money and has been successful, you know, not necessarily by creating quality sites, but by creating sites that he'd sold at a profit in the past, that, like, I think that for him, and this was where it got challenging for us in terms of not just negotiating as a bargaining unit, but in terms of seeing a way forward. And this is eventually what I think led to the resignation, or at least, you know, was a big part of my personal justification for it, is that if the levers that traditionally work don't work, like that if you're dealing with someone who fundamentally only wants to win, and they define that as you losing and capitulating, and if it's the sort of thing where like all of the business justifications that might make a compromise workable, or any of the stuff that you can point to say, like, actually your instinct on this is not right. Like, and if you allow us to continue doing stuff this way, we'll be happier and we'll make you more money. If that doesn't have any appeal to somebody, then it's really hard to know what you can do. Because the only option left then is, you know, just to kind of bend the knee and wait for the next demand or get out.
I mean, I had the same thought about, you know, I mean, I see this with podcasting companies that I pay more attention, obviously, to that area than others. But I just don't know that the margins. I mean, to me, in terms of like internet journalism or internet based journalism, the margins are just not there to get, like you say, the 10x or 100x returns that these, you know, for a guy like Spanfeller, you know, the idea of like of Deadspin making money, right, is not enough. It needs to make enough money so that when he walks into the room, he's the $100 million man or whatever it is.
Yeah.
that marker is. It's just not enough. Like, it's just, like, it's an embarrassment to just make a profit. And I think ultimately, you know, and I think there's statutory stuff that can help with this. You know, we've talked to, and I think there's, you know, plans in the past that talked about like where you have privately owned businesses by families who don't want them to die, but, you know, can't find a buyer, where they can, where the government steps in and provides a loan to workers so that they can buy it and create a cooperative. I mean, like, when, like, Deadspin to me, if I had, I don't know what the operating budget was for Deadspin, but if I had that money and I would just, you know, it had the ability to step in and go like, I'm calling everybody. You guys are going to get the same salary, same benefits. I'm dumping it in. I will make, I'm dumping that money in. I'm paying for the operating expenses. You throw off a 10% profit every year. I'm getting 10% returns on my money. Boom. I'm psyched. And
yeah, it doesn't seem like that bad a deal when you put it like that, because you're making money and you've got a thing that you like.
Yeah.
It's the only model that's really ever worked in journalism. Although,
and then,
I do think that there's co-op stuff. Like, if we owned it,
well, that's
we wouldn't
my
even
point.
Have to listen to that one rich guy. But yeah.
But the point is, like, I could do that as a loan where you're giving me a 10% interest on that loan. You're paying me back X amount of principal every year, and the ownership of the employees increases, their equity increases over the course of, I don't know, a 10-year loan or something. I mean, but if the government provided that loan, even better. Like, you know, and I think, like, that seems to me to be the next step for, you know, where the government steps in and, you know, like, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do with this now. I had the page open to Megan Greenwell's piece and my browser must have timed out because I just got like one of those things like cannot connect. And I was like, holy crap, did they just shut that down? But no, it's I just had to refresh. But I mean, that seems to me to be where it's going. So give me a sense of
well, that's another part. The thing that you just described, I want to talk on that very, very briefly. Because I imagine we're running out of time, but quickly on that.
Not really.
The thing that happened with your page there
is
not unique. This is the problem with the ads, and it was what we were initially pushing back with. They loaded the page so far up with ads and with autoplay video and with a lot of this stuff that the site became very, very difficult to use. And this was pushing readers away, and it was like people that, you know, you can't read it on your phone because it dies, and you can't read it in your office because, a commercial starts blaring out of the speakers at you and everybody looks at you and thinks you're an asshole, then like at that point, it's not just a bad stewardship thing. That's bad business. And this was at the heart of the initial complaint that we had was just sort of like our website's not working. And it's because you fired our UX people and the people that are here now are just kind of like following your strange 2007 style instincts.
Interesting. Yeah, that, yeah. I mean, this is like, if people want to get a really good taste of that, go to any right-wing blog site that serves in your browser will crash in about 30 seconds.
Yeah, they're all like, all these like scammy things where they're just like, you need to, like, your flash is out of date. All this, like, anything that you would see on like, if you've ever like illegally streamed a boxing match, when those same ads are showing up on the website that you work at, you have issues.
I know what you're talking about. If folks can find like European sites that have like five different options and they like lard it up with like pay for this. And like, you have to sort of like, almost like it's like an obstacle course to move your mouse around the thing to get the close box thing that's behind the thing to get I do have to watch the paths sometimes. But all right.
Yeah, it's incredible the ingenuity that goes into that too. It's like there's like one in five New York City stations has like an elevator that works, and yet somehow they found a way to make like the Come Play My Lord ad follow your mouse
that's right.
as you click around the site. Really inspiring stuff.
All right. So give me a sense, like as of today, there's nobody working at Deadspin anymore. Just give me a sense a little bit of like, what was the relationship? Like, did you guys all go into the same office? I'm just curious about the relationship between all the workers there.
Yeah. Everyone that was in New York was in the office, and we work on there's a floor that has all of editorial on it and video production in the podcast studio. And then there's a floor that's like mostly sales. And then it was just us. And Jalopnik, the transportation website, was down there, and then they moved them up. And so we were just kind of hanging out down there, which is a weird feeling, like being in this sort of deserted corner of the office. And as this was all sort of coming down, our editor, acting editor-in-chief after Megan left was Barry Pachesky. On Monday, we got this edict about the Stick to Sports stuff. On Tuesday, we were putting blogs up, but we made a point of not – you know, some of them were not related to sports. Some of them were like sort of silly, like Dom Cosentino, who's our NFL guy, wrote about a video of a bear kind of like wandering around a motel in Tennessee, but like gave the bear a scouting report and was like low center of gravity, not great tape, like lacks burst, you know, which is all like
so arguably
very funny stuff.
Arguably a sports.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
And that was the sort of thing where, like, you know, that's been a gag at sports websites for a long time, because it's you put a bunch of people together in a Slack channel or in an office, and that's what they're sending each other to sort of crack each other up. And I did stuff at SB Nation. I was doing stuff about, like, a llama they call it pronking, but where they basically kind of pogo across a meadow, and someone had made a vine of it doing that to Party Up by DMX. And like, I asked if that was sports, and all my editors were like, hell yeah, that's sports, man. Look at what he's doing. And so we could do a post on it. In this case, though, so we did all that. The posts were there on the webpage. Someone must have shown Spanfeller the webpage. I don't think we accounted for that. We just sort of assumed that we would continue to not read it. Whatever it was, he blew his stack, fired Barry. Am I allowed to use the F word here?
Absolutely.
He told him to, the way he fired him was said, you're fired, get the fuck out. Which is, that's editorial, like sort of a managerial patois, but we were able to figure out that what he meant by that was, you're fired. And then Barry was, so Barry left. And at that point, we were down two editors in chief over a period of 3 months. Barry was the longest tenured guy there. He was the first blog on the site every morning and had been for 10 years. And really was, in terms of like what Deadspin was, I mean, he was the ideal of that. I mean, just in terms of always having a sort of an angle on things. He never, he was strictly about writing about sports, but like he got up earlier than everybody else and he wrote better than everybody else. I mean, it was really just like he was a champ and in that field. And he had a lot of respect. And I think once he was gone, a lot of the other, longer tenured people were starting to, these were people that had worked with him for 8 years or 9 years and that cared about him a lot as a person, but that also sort of realized at this point that this just is going to continue to go on this way as long as we're, under this pressure. And, over the course of that day of Tuesday, everybody sort of began to realize, where we stood and what was happening. Enough people were leaving. It was rumored, and I don't know that this is true or not, but that there would be some sort of punitive hiring freeze. And at this point we had, one editor who's, she had previously arranged so that today was going to be her last day in the office. This was before any of this had happened. She's just leaving to work on other stuff. We had video people leave. We had our social person leave. They weren't hiring anyone to replace them. And so there was just this sense of either, you just hang on and watch it go away, or we would leave together. And then once it became clear that no one really wanted to have to deal with this stuff indefinitely, it was at that point, that was over the course of a couple of meetings in different offices, with remote people on the phone or on LifeSize, which is the message, like a meeting technology thing. I'm sure it's very good. I never actually figured out how to use it. But all of that was, that's as bad as I felt in a work capacity, ever. Like where I've been, laid off before, it was Vice pulled the plug on Vice Sports. SB Nation, I wasn't a fit with where they were going, and that was that. And that all sucked and was really painful, obviously, and really worrying. But it was never anything like this, where it was just a question of how long are you going to be able to hang on and watch this happen. And then as more people left, it was just clear that there was nothing really to even go back to.
Well, it's obviously a huge loss to the readers of Deadspin. And I think people should understand it's a loss, even if you didn't read the site. Because this is indicative of a much larger problem that we're having. And on top of the fact that you have a lot of people out there who have lost their job and all the sort of like, the misery that entails for these people, it is it's indicative of a larger problem. And I know, too, that you also did a podcast there, the Deadcast. And I will tell you right now, I imagine you're going to have opportunities to that maybe somebody else will pick it up. But if you want to talk about doing it without a boss, give me a call. We can talk about
it. Man, I appreciate that very much. Thank you. and thanks for having me on.
David, thanks so much, and I appreciate it. Folks can follow David Roth. What's your Twitter handle?
It is @David_J_Roth. That was just in case David Lee Roth ever got on there, I wanted to make sure that I had my brand secure.
Super smart to do the double underscore.
Yeah, savvy.
Nobody else
would
ever do
that. Yeah, that's it. People love typing them. I didn't make the rules, man.
All right, David, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, dude. I appreciate it.
Hang in there.
Have a good one.
Boy, I'll tell you something. I just watched that happen, and it reminded me of the nightmare that we would go through at Air America every like 9 months. And but good for everybody there, at least for, you know, sort of deciding to jump off and leave that dude.
Very awesome.
Sitting in his empty office, proud of himself.
And it still breaks my heart to think about it, because this was my career up until I started working here, pretty much. And I don't think I'm going to be going back, because it's a shit show.
I honestly think that there's, you know, I mean, we say this all the time, but I mean, like, you see a guy like Tom Steyer, who's now spent, what's he up to? Like $60 million? Is the dude even going to get on the debate stage?
Like, he is the next one.
He is?
Yeah.
And he had, what, three things he said last time? And for the life of me, you could pay me that $60 million, and I would not be able to tell you what they were, like, beyond him saying, like, we tried to get impeachment, and then everything else is just complete Melba toast.
He also said Bernie's right.
I agree. We just need to be smart about it. That's his message.
But you know, maybe it's not Tom Steyer, but the idea, like, that we have these, you know, there are people out there, and I can't imagine. I have no idea what the Deadspin, you know, sort of like annual operating budget is. But if it was more than like $5 million, I'd be shocked. And I imagine it was less, but I don't know. I have no idea about these things. I know that at Air America, when we were in bankruptcy, we had our lowest burn rate. And that was like maybe it was $3 million a year. And we had a nice, big, full floor office on 6th Avenue. And, you know, we were doing a 15, 16 hours a day of programming, you know, fully staffed. And we had a website that was, you know, the idea of this being a co-op, like just somebody stepping in and just saying, like, even as a loan, you know, like if it's $5 million, I'll loan you the money. And by year two, the revenue is coming in that can keep the thing alive and throw off, you know, 10-20% profit that goes to your VIG and to paying back the principal.
Yeah. But when you go to an event in Iowa, some people still have to introduce you as the next president of the United States. And that feels cool.
I just don't get it. I just don't get it.
So what do I want to spend my $5 million so that some like snarky asshole like
Steyer
talks about Pats games and says my taxes should go up? Or maybe I could run for president and enjoy myself.
But the thing is, Tom Steyer could, like, it could be one of those situations, like, you know, you like sometimes when I come back from Vegas, I get $100 bills.
Give me money, Tom.
And there's been one occasion where I had a $100 bill in like a pair of pants.
Right.
Or like in a sport jacket that I never wear. And I didn't find it for like 2 years later.
Oh, you, like, must have been so stoked.
I was actually pretty stoked. I guess that cuts against what I was going to say. Like, that's like $5 million. Tom Steyer is just like, oh, did I leave that there? You know what? I don't have time to get back. I'll just get it the next time I'm over your
house. Tom Steyer is probably stoked. He's like, I could scam. You know how many email addresses I could scam with a fake civic campaign with this $5 million I found it? Or I could flip it into Geo Group. $5 million works so well.
So annoying to see this happening. But I think, honestly, like, at one point, and, you know, waiting for a billionaire to do this is just not worth it.
No.
I think we need to have statutes where, and And I don't know if that law, and I can't remember for the life of me who it is I was talking to, who I think it was a congressman, and maybe it was on Ring of Fire, who said like there is a statute on the books, or the one that was voting on, to do that with businesses that were owned by family-owned businesses. When they sell them, there would be a government bridge loan that would allow the employees to buy it. There should be statutes. And, you know, I almost think that, like, I don't know how you would frame it in such a way. Like, obviously, you can't force Spanfeller to sell this. But I think there should be an option that's out there so that these guys at Deadspin, when they're getting around the office, can say, like, maybe we should just do a 327i, which is, like, where you get the government loan. Like, we can all do
that's
this.
That's what Labor is putting forward in the UK. That's what awesome. Labor has the most extensive, and Bernie has a similar one, but the Labor's is really ambitious. That, the government will step in for mid-sized to small loans to create that possibility.
Yeah. And that, to me, you know, whether it's like Uber-style stuff, like everything web-based, it seems to me, is, unless you're talking about sort of like a web-based retail, major retail type of thing, whatever it is. I don't know what the constrictions are on this. But the fact is that, like, I am always very suspicious of, like, you know, not to single them out, but when Gimlet was bought for $230 million by Spotify or whatever it was.
Gimlet was that? Wasn't was that? How much the how much acquisition was,
that supposedly was? I'm like,
that is insane.
I don't know how the hell that's happening.
What, like, we're going to do is these podcasts going to be more than 200.
Yeah, like, I don't know. I was always like, really? Are they going to get that money back?
First, it's a podcast.
Going to sell Literary Hangover for $15 million.
And listen, you know, I've been approached by people who say, like, this is, you know, this people who had, you know, money or access to private equity money who come in and say this. And I'm like, I can't wrap my head around how anybody's going to make that money back. And I'm like, I don't want to, like, wake up in the morning and have to pretend that, like, oh, yeah, we're just days away from that $100 million revenue. And don't worry about a thing. Just want to play some ping pong in the I do think
it's not fictitious.
Commissary.
Our parody of the startup podcast would be funny.
Yeah.
That
was really, when we were working on that, it's like, so how do I do a pump and dump? Right. Like with the NPR voice. like, and you're telling me you can have 30,000 clicks extra that aren't real?
We are, I don't know what they call it, MCM or something. We're under the auspices of the Young Turks. They do some of the optimizing for our YouTube channel. And I got offers to leave. You know, we pay them a percentage of what we make. And I got offers to leave, like, by this company from Canada. I can't remember what it was called, like Booming Media or something like that. And the guy would write, and he goes, like, we have a new platform that will promote you across thing. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't think so. And then the next week, a different rep from the same place would be like, hey, I'm Stefan, from Boomer Media, and we're prepared to give you $1,000 signing bonus. And then I'm like, is this like some type of phishing thing? And then it got up to like $5,000 or $10,000. And I'm like,
yeah, just give me your personal information and we'll get this deal going.
But it turns out it wasn't. And I was like, I don't understand how they're doing this. Like, how do you make money by paying money to people to not give you, like, I didn't see what the business plan was. And then I was talking to one of these guys. They're like, oh, what they're trying to do is show bigger fish that they have this revenue. And I'm like, but they're paying me to just have my revenue on their books, even though they're not getting anything from it. And they're like, yeah, no, they don't check on how much it costs to get that revenue. Everybody assumes they can cut costs. It's nuts in my mind, but.
Well, maybe someday, smart, with the help of President Bernie, we here at Majority Report will make you an offer you can't refuse.
Yes, well,
we'll do some kind of leveraged.
Damn that 231i7 idea.
No.
All right, folks. Just a reminder.
Dead hands.
That's, well,
we'll be coming for TMBS too.
I was just going to say, I think obviously we need to cap it at a certain size. Let's not be ridiculous here.
My show's already a workaround co-op, just saying.
We'll spread that around too a little bit.
We'll see. We'll see what workaround really means.
All right, folks. Speaking of which, you can be... Well, I guess we haven't quite figured out that part of the model yet, but you can be a member of the Majority Report, and you could do so and support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show commercial free. You get it. You get extended versions of the show as well, and you have. It's still, obviously, you can search the member archive on our app. I mean, all sorts of benefits. Also, don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Reminder, we've had a lot of people who are taking us up on the offer. If you don't have the financial resources to become a member, but you want access to the fun half of the show, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Over the next week or so, depending on my schedule with my kids, we will get back to those, and we will hook you up by hook or crook, as it were. Meanwhile, this episode is brought to you by Blinkist. The Blinkist app takes the key takeaways from thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and condenses them down to just 15 minutes for you to read or listen to. 10 million people are using Blinkist right now. Make it 10 million one. Let them know you're listening to the show. It has a massive and growing library from self-help and business to health and history books. Right now, you can get 25% off your first year at Blinkist at Blinkist.com/majority. That's Blinkist, Blinkist.com/majority. Michael, today is Friday. That means that Tuesday happened. What happened on Tuesday?
What happened on Tuesday? Shama Sawant, Crystal Ball, and Harvey J.K. We released the Slavoj Žižek conversation for patrons, which was fantastic. I recommend people get an early peek at that, as well as the Adolf Reed interview. This coming Tuesday, we are, in fact, playing that Adolf Reed interview, and Abby Martin's making her debut on the show to talk about Gaza and why Trump is expanding empire. Contrary to the mythology of isolationism, patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, we had on the very funny podcast host from Minion Death Cult, wherein we talk about Halloween, some of our fun Mischief Night stories, and we read some hilarious boomer and other kinds of posts from the internet. We got some Christians who are mad about Halloween. We commemorated last year's Antifa Super Soldier Revolution, if you guys remember that. That was 1 year ago. We recalled InfoWars attacks on me earlier this year, and we closed out with some Tim Pool Joker posting. Also, out today for our patrons, it's part two of History is a Weapon on Suburbia with Matt Chrisman and Sean KB. Those guys really know their stuff. They talk about all kinds. I'm not even going to read this. Just listen to it. It's great. You're going to love it. That's all. Patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Now, is All Mischief's Night, is that when you grow up, was that the same night as Halloween, or is that
it's different? The night before.
It's the night before.
Yeah, they also call it Devil's Night in some places.
Yeah, in Worcester, same night.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's weird.
I mean, you can get up to mischief on Halloween as well. Andy had a very on-brand story about how he would cruise around his neighborhood, and if there was a house with too many pumpkins, he would take some of those pumpkins and redistribute them to the houses with no pumpkins.
Oh, that was nice. We would just throw eggs at people.
It's pumpkinhood.
That was it. We just threw eggs. Rode bikes, threw eggs, tried to get away from the bigger kids who would throw eggs at us.
Oh, no, the big kids are coming. Let's throw it at the old lady's house and then go home for matzo ball soup.
On a literary hangover, I did an episode.
I really
on the,
dial it up.
Yeah. Don't talk over my plug. On the material and political history of the Salem witch trials of 1692. So check that out, folks.
See you.
Plugs are so short too.
See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Almost says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ the Anarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck! Reminder!
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
What? What? What?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
What? Come on! What?
Come on! Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy. 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 Pussy.